You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures in four parts by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Harmony of the Creative Word, the Human Being and the Elemental, Animal, Plant and Mineral Kingdoms, formerly known as Man as Symphony of the Creative Word, Collected Works, Volume 230, Revised Translation by Matthew Barton. This is the last lecture in the second part. The second part is entitled The Interconnection of World Phenomena and the Essential Nature of the World. This is Lecture 6, given on the 28th of October, 1923. Before we proceed to the study of the other members of the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms, which are connected with man, we must first cast a glance at the development of man himself and call to mind various descriptions already familiar to us through books or lectures. This will give us the necessary overview. If we look to present-day science for instruction, we are usually told that it is necessary to investigate how the so-called higher forms of the plant, animal, and human kingdoms have evolved out of lifeless, so-called inorganic substances or forces. A true conception of evolution reveals something essentially different. It reveals, as you will have been able to gather from my title Occult Science, that man in his present form is the being who has the longest evolution behind him, an evolution that goes back to the time of ancient Saturn. We must therefore say that man is the oldest creature within the evolution of our Earth. It was only during the Sun period, Old Sun period, that animal nature was added, then during the Old Moon period, plant nature, and the mineral kingdom, as we know it today, is in fact an earth product, something which was only added during the earth period of evolution. Let us now consider man in his present form and ask ourselves, what part of man evolved earliest? It is the human head. This first evolved at a time when the Earth was in its Saturn metamorphosis. It is true that ancient Saturn consisted entirely of heat substance, and that the human head was then actually flowing, moving, surging heat. It then acquired gaseous form during the Old Sun period, and fluid form during the Old Moon period, when it became a liquid flowing entity. And only during the earth period did it receive the solid form with its bony parts. We must therefore say that a being of which it is difficult to gain a conception through today's external forms of knowledge existed during the time of ancient Saturn, and of this being the human head is the descendant. And simultaneously with the formation of man's head, this can be gathered from my recent descriptions. Simultaneously with the first beginnings of the human head during the Saturn period, the first beginnings of butterfly nature also came into existence. Later we shall make a more exact study of the nature of the other insects, but to begin with, let us stay with butterfly nature. When we follow the course of evolution from the ancient Saturn period until today, until Earth existence, we must say that at that time, the beginnings of the human head came into existence in a form of very delicate substance, and at the same time there arose everything which now flutters through the air as the world of the butterflies. The two evolutionary paths proceeded further. Man developed his inner being, so that to an ever greater degree he manifested a soul nature, and radiated outward from within. The butterfly, on the other hand, is a being on whose exterior the cosmos may be said to lavish all its beauties. The butterfly is a creature on which everything of beauty and majesty in the cosmos, as this has been described to you, has, as it were, alighted together with the dust on its wings. We must, therefore, picture butterfly nature as a mirror which reflects the beauties of the upper cosmos, the human being takes up into himself, encloses within himself, what is of the nature of the upper cosmos, and thus becomes inwardly ensouled. It is like a concentration of the cosmos, which then radiates outward, giving form to itself in the human head. So that in the human head we have something formed from within outward. But in the butterfly, we have something formed from outside in. Someone who sees these things with the eye of vision, EYE, learns something really tremendous if he sets to work in the following way. He says, I wish to fathom the mysteries, the most ancient mysteries, the old Saturn mysteries of the human head. I wish to know the true nature of the forces that have held sway inside the skull. He must then let his attention be directed to what is everywhere to be seen outside, to what everywhere streams inward from outside. To come to know the marvel that is your own head, study the marvels of how the butterfly came to be in the world of nature outside. This is the great lesson imparted by a study of the cosmos through spiritual observation. Evolution then proceeded from the old Saturn period to the old Sun period, and now a being came into existence, possessed of a further development, an air development, an air metamorphosis of the head. But to this there was added in very delicate substance what later became the organs of the chest, became the breathing apparatus and the heart of man. In old Saturn we still have essentially the metamorphosis that represents the human head. When we come to the old Sun period, we have the head and chest. For it was now that the part was added which today is the human chest. At the same time, however, there already came into existence, in the later part of the old Saturn period and the earlier part of the old Sun period, what must now be seen as having its representative in the eagle. The bird kingdom arose in the first part of the old Sun period. And in the second part of the old Sun period there arose the first rudiments of that kingdom of the animals, which are in fact chest animals, as for instance the lion. Other chest animals too, but the lion is their representative. So that the first beginnings of these animals go back to the time of old Sun. From this you can see what a stupendous difference exists when it comes to the evolution of even the higher animals and of man. In the future I shall still have to speak about the transitional animals, which include the apes, but today my intention is just to give a comprehensive overview. Footnote, see, for example, Steiner's lecture of 6 August 1924, entitled The Evolution of the Earth and Man, at the Vesopic Press, New York, 1987. End of footnote. You see what an immense difference exists between the development of man and the development of the higher animals. In the case of human evolution, it was the head which first took form. All the other organs are, as it were, appended. They may be said to have attached themselves to the formation of the head. In cosmic evolution, man's development proceeds from the head downward. On the other hand, the lion, for example, first came into existence during the old Sun period as a chest animal, as an animal with a powerful breathing system, but with a head still very small and poorly developed. And only in later times, when the sun separated from the earth and then worked from outside, only then did the head develop out of the chest. Thus the development of the lion was such that it evolved from the chest upward, whereas the human being evolved from the head downward. This constitutes an immense difference in evolution as a whole. And when we now proceed to the old moon metamorphosis of the earth, because the old moon represented the water condition, because the old moon was fluid, though it certainly developed a horn-like substance in its later period. It was only then that the human being needed a further extension downward. The beginnings of the digestive system developed. During the old sun period, while man possessed only what was of the nature of air, undulating, scintillating with light, all he required for the purpose of nourishment was a breathing apparatus shut off from below. Man was a head and breathing organism. Now during the old moon period, he acquired a digestive system, thereby becoming a being of head, chest, and abdomen. And because everything in the old moon was still watery substance, the human being had outgrowths during this old moon period which buoyed him up as he swam through the water. We can only speak of arms and legs during the earth period, when the force of gravity took effect, and the part developed that is primarily aligned to the lines of gravity, the limbs. This therefore belongs only to the earth period. During the old moon period, however, the digestive system was formed, though still quite differently constituted from what it was to be later on, for man's digestive apparatus did not as yet need to assimilate all that serves the free, independent mobility of the limbs. It was still an essentially different digestive system. This was later metamorphosed into the digestive apparatus appropriate to the earth. It was, however, during the old moon period that man first acquired his digestive system. And then it came about that, to the descendants of the butterflies, of the birds, and of such species as are represented by the lion, were added the animals that are predominantly designed for digestion. Thus, during the old moon period, we have the addition of the animals that are represented by the cow. How then did the development of the cow proceed in contrast to that of the human being? Here, matters were such that in this old moon period, it was first and foremost the cow's digestive apparatus that evolved. Then, after the moon had separated, the chest organs grew out from the digestive system, as did also the characteristically shaped head. Man began his development with the head, adding to this the chest, and finally the digestive organs. The lion began with the chest organs, adding to these the head, and then, during the old moon period, acquiring the digestive organs at the same time as man did. The animals represented by the cow had first as a primary beginning the digestive organs, and then growing out from these the organs of the chest and head. So you see, man grew from the head downward, the lion from the chest both up and downward, the cow grew from its digestive organs into chest and head, so that compared to the human being, it grew entirely in an upward direction and developed toward heart and head. That is what we see when we consider the evolution of the human being. Here the question naturally arises, is it only the cow which was, one can say, the companion thus associated with man's evolution? This is not entirely so. For whenever any kind of planetary metamorphosis takes place, the earlier creatures develop further, while at the same time new ones come into existence. The cow already came into being during the first phase of old moon metamorphosis. Then, however, other animals were added, and these had their earliest beginning in the last phase of the old moon metamorphosis. These could not, for example, take part in the departure of the moon, for it had already separated off. Nor could they participate in what this departure brought about, namely the drawing forth, as it were, from the cow's belly of the organs of heart and head. The creatures which made their appearance later remained at the stage which in man is focused in digestion, the stage which man carries with him in his abdomen. And just as the eagle and the butterflies are constituted in relation to the head, the lion in relation to the chest, the cow in relation to the abdomen, though it was also able to develop all the upper organs at a later period of evolution, so the amphibians and reptiles, such as toads, frogs, snakes, lizards, are related, if I may put it so, to the lower organs of the human being, those of the human digestive system. They are simply digestive organs which came into existence as animals. These last creatures appeared during the second old moon period in an extremely clumsy-looking form, and were in fact walking stomachs and entrails, walking stomachs and intestinal tubes. And only later, during the earth period, did they also acquire a still not particularly distinguished-looking head system. Just look at frogs and toads, or at snakes. They came into existence as animals of digestion at a late period, at a time when man could only append his digestive apparatus to what he had already acquired during an earlier period. And in the earth period, when man acquired his limbs under the influence of gravity and earth magnetism, the tortoises, we may take the tortoises as representative animals in this, stretched their head out beyond their armored shell in a manner more like an organ of the limb system than a head. And now we can understand how it is that in the case of the amphibians and reptiles, the head is formed in such an uncouth way. Its form is such that one really has the feeling, and rightly so, that here one passes directly from the mouth into the stomach. There is hardly anything in between. When we study man in this way and relate his animal companions to the different aspects of his nature, we must assign what is comprised in the reptiles and amphibians to the human activity of digestion. And one can actually say, just as man carries around in his intestines the products of his digestion, so does the cosmos carry around, indirectly by way of the earth, toads, snakes, and frogs in the cosmic intestine which it created for itself in the watery, earthly element of the earth. On the other hand, all that is more connected with human reproduction, which appeared in its earliest beginnings in the very last phase of the moon period, and only developed fully during the earth metamorphosis, with this the fishes are related, the fishes and still lower animals, so that we have to regard the fishes as late arrivals in evolution, as creatures that only joined the company of the other animals at a time when man added his organs of reproduction to those of digestion. The snake is the intermediary between the organs of reproduction and digestion. Rightly viewed in regard to human nature, what does the snake represent? It represents what is known as the renal tubule. It originated in world evolution at the same time as the renal tubule developed in man. Thus we can actually follow the way the human being, beginning with the head, grew downward, how the earth drew forth from him the limbs and made them its servants, so that these limbs are within the earth equilibrium of gravity and magnetic forces, and simultaneously with this downward growth, the different classes of the animals took form. You see, this gives us a true picture of the evolution of the earth and its creatures. And in accordance with this evolution, these creatures have developed in such a way that they present themselves to us as they are today. When you look at the butterflies and the birds, you certainly have earthly forms. But you know from what has been said before that the butterfly is really a light being, and earthly substance has, as it were, only alighted on it. If the butterfly itself could tell you what it is, it would announce to you that it has a body made of light, and that, as I have already said, it carries about what has alighted on it in the way of earthly matter, like luggage, like something external to itself. Similarly, one can say that the bird is a creature of warm air, for the true bird is the warm air that is diffused throughout its body. All else is its luggage, which it carries with it through the world. These creatures, which even today have still preserved their nature of light and warmth, and are really only clothed with a terrestrial, an earthly, a watery vestment, were the very earliest to arise in the whole of Earth evolution. Their very forms can remind anyone who is able to look back to the time which man passed through in the spiritual world, before his descent into earthly life, of occurrences in the spiritual world. Certainly they are earthly forms, for earthly matter has alighted on them. If we conceive rightly the hovering, swooping creature of the light that is the real butterfly, thinking away everything of an earthly nature which has alighted on it, if we think away from the bird everything of earth which has alighted on it, if we picture the assembly of forces which makes of the bird a creature of warm air, with its plumage in reality just shining rays, if we imagine all this, then these creatures, which only look as they do and are the size they are because of their outer vestment, remind the seer, who knows what the nature of the human being was before the descent to earth, of that human descent. Then one who can thus gaze into the spiritual world says to himself, "The butterflies and the birds remind us of the spirit forms among which men dwelt before he descended to earth, of the beings of the higher hierarchies." Looked at with understanding, butterflies and birds are a memory, transformed into miniature and metamorphosed, of the forms that man had around him as spirit forms before he descended into earth evolution. Because earth substance is heavy and must be overcome, the butterflies contract into miniature, the gigantic form which is in reality theirs. If you could separate from a butterfly everything of the nature of earth substance, it would be able, as spirit being, as a creature of the light, to expand to archangelic form. In the creatures that inhabit the air, we have the earthly images of spiritual forms that exist in higher regions. This is why in the time of instinctive clairvoyance, it was the natural thing in artistic creation to derive from the forms of the winged creatures the symbolic form, the pictorial form of the beings of the higher hierarchies. This has its inner justification. Essentially, the physical forms of butterflies and birds are really the physical metamorphoses of spiritual beings. It is not the spiritual beings themselves which have undergone metamorphosis, but these forms are their metamorphosed images. They are, of course, different beings. You will therefore also find it understandable that I return to something which I have already discussed, and I again draw what follows in a diagram. I told you that the butterfly, which is essentially a creature of the light, continually sends spiritualized earth matter out into the cosmos during its lifetime. I'd like to call this spiritualized earth substance, which is sent out into the cosmos, borrowing a term customary in solar physics, the butterfly corona. That is how the butterfly corona continually radiates out into the cosmos. But into this butterfly corona radiates what the bird kingdom yields up to the cosmos every time a bird dies, so that the spiritualized matter from the bird kingdom radiates into the corona and out into the cosmos. Thus in spiritual perception, one beholds a shimmering corona emanating from the butterfly kingdom. Certain laws allow this to continue in winter also. And in a more ray-like form, introduced into it, one beholds what streams out from the birds. You see, when the human being has the impulse to descend from the spiritual world to the physical world, it is the butterfly corona, this remarkable outstreaming of spiritualized earth substance, which first calls him into earthly existence. Gotta read that again. You see, when the human being has the impulse to descend from the spiritual world to the physical world, it is the butterfly corona, this remarkable outstreaming of spiritualized earth substance, which first calls him into earthly existence. And the rays of the bird corona are experienced more as forces that enter into the corona. Now you perceive an even higher significance in what has its life in the encircling air. We must look for the spiritual in everything that is alive and active within reality. And it is only when one looks for the spiritual that one comes to the significance of various different species and spheres of being. The earth entices man back into incarnation by sending forth into world space the shining radiance of the butterfly corona and the rays of the bird corona. These call man back again into a new earthly existence after he has spent a certain period of time between death and rebirth in the purely spiritual world. It is therefore not to be wondered at if man finds it difficult to unravel the complex feelings which he rightly experiences when beholding the world of the butterflies and the birds. For the true reality of these dwells deep in the subconscious. What really works in them is the remembrance of a longing for new earthly existence. This again is connected with something I have often spoken of, namely that the human being, when he has departed from the earth through the portal of death, actually disperses his head, and that then the remainder of his organism, naturally, in regard to its forces, not in regard to its matter, becomes metamorphosed into the head of his next earthly existence. Thus man is striving toward his head when he is striving toward his descent. And it is the head which is the first part of the human embryo to develop in a form which already resembles the later human form. All this has to do with the fact that this directing of development toward the head is intimately connected with what works and moves in the world of the flying creatures, by means of which man is drawn out of supersensible into sensible existence. Footnote, see also Rudolf Steiner's lecture on, quote, cosmic formative forces in relation to the hierarchies, close quote, Dornach, 16th of July, 1921. That's found in the Collected Works, Volume 205. End of footnote. The human being, therefore, first acquires his head organization during the embryonic period. After this, the digestive organization and so forth develops out of earthly existence, and it does so inside the mother's body. Just as the upper part, the development of the head, is connected with what is of the nature of warmth and air, with the warmth light element, so what is now added during the embryonic period is connected with the element of earth and fluid. It follows the same pattern as the parts appended during the later stages of human evolution. The element of earth and fluid must, however, be prepared in a quite special way, and this has to be in the mother's body. If it evolved separately, scattered over the earthly world outside, it would develop into lower animal forms, such as amphibians and reptiles, or into fishes and even lower animals. The butterfly rightly regards itself as a creature of the light, the bird as a being of warm air. But this is impossible for the lower animals, amphibians, reptiles, and fishes. Let us first consider the fishes as they are today, as they come into existence subject to external forces that work on them from the outside, whereas they work on man from inside. A fish lives primarily in the element of water, but water is certainly not just the combination of hydrogen and oxygen, which it is for the chemist. Water is permeated by all kinds of cosmic forces. Stellar forces also enter into it. No fish would be able to live in water if it were merely a homogeneous combination of hydrogen and oxygen. just as the butterfly feels itself to be a creature of the light and the bird a creature of warm air, so the fish feels itself to be a creature of earth and water. It does not feel the actual water which it absorbs to be part of its own being. A bird does feel the air which it inhales to be part of its own being. Thus the bird actually feels the air that enters into it and is everywhere diffused through it as its own being. This air which is diffused through the bird and warmed by it, this is its being. The fish has water within it, yet it does not feel itself to be water. The fish feels itself to be what encloses the water, what surrounds the water. It feels itself to be the glittering shell or vessel enclosing the water. But the water itself is felt by the fish to be an element foreign to it, which passes in and out, and in doing so also provides the air which the fish needs. Yet air and water are felt by the fish as something foreign. In its physical nature, the fish experiences the water as something foreign to it. But the fish also has its ether and astral bodies, and it is just this which is the remarkable thing about the fish, because it really experiences itself as a vessel, and feels that the water this vessel encloses remains connected with all the rest of the watery element. The fish experiences the ether to be the element in which it actually lives. It does not feel the astral as something belonging to it. Thus the fish has the peculiar characteristic that it is so entirely a creature of the ether. It feels itself as the physical vessel for the water. It feels the water within itself as part and parcel with all the waters of the world. Fluid continues on into every part of it, as it were. Fluid is everywhere. And in this wetness, the fish at the same time experiences the ether. For earthly life, fishes are certainly dumb. But if they could speak and tell you what they feel, they would say, quote, "I am a vessel." But the vessel contains the all-pervading element of water, which is the bearer of the element of ether. I am really swimming in the ether. Close quote. The fish would say, quote, "Water is only Maya. The reality is the ether. And it is in this that I really swim." Close quote. Thus the fish feels its life to be at one with the life of the earth. This is the peculiar thing about the fish. It feels its life as the life of the earth, and therefore takes an intimate part in everything which the earth experiences during the course of the year. Experiencing the outgoing of the etheric forces in summer, the withdrawing of etheric forces in winter, the fish experiences something which breathes within the whole earth. The fish perceives the etheric element as the breathing process of the earth. Dr. Wachsmuth once spoke here about the breathing of the earth. This was a very beautiful description. If a fish had learned the art of lecturing, it would have given the very same lecture here out of its own experience, for it perceives everything that was described in this lecture from having itself participated in all the phenomena in question. The fish is the creature which takes part in quite an extraordinary way in the breathing life of the earth during the cycle of the year. Because what is important for the fish is the element of life, the ether that surges out and in, drawing all other aspects of breathing with it. It is otherwise with the reptiles and with the amphibians, with the frogs, for instance, which are remarkably characteristic in this respect. They are not so much connected with the ether in the cosmos. They are connected more with the astral element. If one were to ask a fish, quote, "What exactly is your situation?" close quote, it would answer, quote, "Well, yes, here on earth I have become an earthly creature, made out of the element of earth and water, but my real life is the life of the whole earth with its cosmic breathing." Close quote. This is not so with the frog. Here matters are essentially different. The frog shares in the astrality that is to be found everywhere. In regard to the plants, I told you, and I shall speak further of this, how the astrality of the cosmos touches the flower. The frog is connected with this astrality, with what may be called the astral body of the earth, just as the fish is connected with the earth's ether body. The fish possesses its astrality more for itself. The frog possesses its ether body very much for itself, much more so than the fish. But the frog lives in the general astrality. It shares particularly in the astral processes that occur in the cycle of the year, when the earth brings its astrality into play in the evaporation of water and its recondensation. Here the materialistically minded person naturally says that the evaporation of water is caused by aerodynamic, or if you will, aeromechanical forces of one kind or another. These cause the ascent. Drops are formed, and when they become heavy enough, they fall downward. But this is almost as though one were to put forward a similar theory about the circulation of the human blood, without taking into consideration the fact that everything is full of life in the circulation of the blood. In the same way, the astral atmosphere of the earth's astrality, lives in the circulation of water as it goes up and goes down again and comes down again. And I am telling you no fairy tale when I say that it is just the frogs. This is also the case with the other amphibians, but to a less pronounced degree, that live in this play of astrality which manifests in weather conditions, in meteorology. It is not only that frogs are used, as you know, in a simple, easy way to foretell the weather, but they experience this astral play so wonderfully, because their own astrality places them right into the astrality of the earth. The frog does not even say, quote, "I have a feeling," close quote. It is merely the bearer of the feelings that the earth has in wet spells, in dry spells, and so on. This is also why in certain weather conditions you have the more or less beautiful or ugly frogs' concerts. For this is the frog's way of expressing what they experience in conjunction with the astral body of the earth. They actually do not croak unless they are moved to do so by what comes from the whole cosmos. They live with the astrality of the earth. So we can say that the creatures that live in the element of earth and moisture also have more of a living experience of the earth. Earthly life conditions, in the case of the fish, and earthly feeling conditions, in the case of the frog, and reptiles and amphibians in general. Again, if we wish to study the human digestive organism, we must say that it has developed from within and on this particular pattern. However, if we really wish to study how it functions, we must turn to the world of amphibians and reptiles, for the forces with which the human being imbues his digestive apparatus comes to them from outside. The same forces by means of which man digests are used by the outer cosmos, by outer nature, to produce snakes, toads, lizards, and frogs. And whoever wishes to make a real study, forgive me, but there is nothing ugly in nature. Everything must be considered objectively. Whoever wishes to study the inner nature of, let us say, the human colon with its powers of excretion, must study the toads in outer nature. For there comes to the toads from outside what works in the same pattern, but from within, outward, in the human colon. Certainly this does not lend itself to such beautiful descriptions as what I had to say about the butterflies, but everything in nature must be viewed with objective impartiality. In this way, you see, you also gain a picture of how the earth shares in the life of the cosmos. Turn your attention to what may be called the earth's excretory organs. The earth excretes not only the nearly lifeless products of human excretion, but it also excretes what is living. And among its actual excretions are the toads. In them the earth rids itself of what it is unable to use. From all this you can see how outer nature always corresponds to what is within us. Anyone who says, quote, "No mind has been created that penetrates the inner life of nature," close quote, simply does not know that the inner life of nature is to be found everywhere in the outside world. We can study the entire human being in regard to his inner nature if we understand what is alive and active outside in the cosmos. We can study the human being from head to limb system if we study what is present in the outside world. World and man belong together in every respect, and one can even represent this in a diagram. We draw the circumference or periphery of a large circle. Its power is concentrated in a point. The periphery gives rise to a smaller circle inside. The point at the center radiates outward to create the same form. The smaller periphery in turn generates an even smaller circle. The power inside again radiates outward to create the same form. The new periphery creates a further one, and again the human being radiates outward. Thus the outer aspect of the human being comes into contact with the inner nature of the cosmos. At the point where our senses come in contact with the world, the part of us that has gone out from the inner center comes in contact with what in the cosmos has entered from the periphery. In this sense, man is a small world, a microcosm in relation to the macrocosm. But he contains all the wonders and secrets of the macrocosm, only in a reversed evolutionary direction. It would be something very adverse to the further evolution of the earth if things were only as I have so far described them. Then the earth would excrete the toads and would one day perish, just as physical man must perish, without any continuation. So far, however, we have only considered man's connection with the animals, and have built only a tentative bridge to plant nature. We shall now have to penetrate further into the plant world, and then into the mineral world, and we shall see how the mineral world arose during the earth period. How, for instance, the rock formations of our primary mountains were laid down bit by the plants, and how, bit by bit, the limestone mountains were laid down by the animals that came later. The mineral kingdom is the deposit of the plant and animal kingdom, and it is mainly the deposit of the lowest animals. The toads do not contribute very much to the mineral element of the earth. The fishes, too, comparatively little. But the lower animals and the plants contribute a very great deal. The lower creatures, those plated with siliceous and calcareous armor or calcareous shells, deposit what they have first created out of their own animal or plant natures, and the mineral then disintegrates. And when this mineral substance disintegrates, a power of the highest order takes hold of just these products of mineral disintegration and from them builds up new worlds. The mineral element in any particular place can become of all things the most important. When we follow the course of Earth evolution, heat state, airy state, watery state, mineral earthly state, the human head has participated in all these metamorphoses, the mineral metamorphosis initially on the outside in the decaying skeleton of the head, though this still retains a certain vitality. But the human head has participated in the earthly mineral metamorphosis in a way which is even more apparent. In the center of the human head, within the structure of the brain, there is an organ shaped like a pyramid, the pineal body. This gland, situated in the vicinity of the superior colliculi, corpora quadrigemina, and the optic thalamus, secretes out of itself the so-called brain sand, minute lemon-yellow stones, which lie in little heaps at one end of the pineal body, and which are truly the mineral element in the human head. If they do not lie there, if a human being does not have this brain sand, this mineral element within him, he becomes mentally retarded. In the case of normal people, the pineal gland is comparatively large. In the mentally retarded, pineal bodies have been found which are actually no larger than hemp seeds. These cannot secrete brain sand. It is actually in this mineral deposit that the spirit man is anchored. And this immediately shows that what is living cannot harbor the spirit, but that the spirit in man needs something non-living as its center, which means that above all else, it must be a spirit with independent life. A beautiful progression has taken us from butterfly and head development and bird and head development all the way down to the reptiles and fishes. We will now reascend and study what will give us as much satisfaction as the succession of animals, the succession of plants, and that of minerals. And just as we have been able to learn about the past from the succession of animals, so shall we be able to derive hope for the future of the earth from the succession of minerals. At the same time, it will of course still be necessary in the following lectures to enter into the nature of transitional animals from the most varied aspects. For in this survey, I have only been able to touch on the animals of principal significance, which, so to say, appear as the key points of evolution. And that is the end of Lecture 6 and the end of Part 2 of the four parts of this lecture series. And this Part 2 was called The Inner Connection of World Phenomena and the Essential Nature of the World.